Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Just Interesting podcast, the show that's not too boring, it's not too interesting, it's just interesting enough. And joining me, as always, today is Robin.
Hello, how are you, Robin? Alex. I am well, and I am excited because we've got a very special guest with us today, Erik Jernes Hansen, who is a genuinely great author who is very kind enough to hire me this year to narrate the audiobook version of a novel that he wrote a few years ago called Brutalization, which is available on most, if not all, good audiobook and ebook platforms. There will be some links in the description below on YouTube and possibly some links in the description on your podcast platform of choice. And it's a book that draws on your experience, doesn't it, Erik, in law enforcement?
Yeah, it does. It's inspired by some of my experiences. It's fiction, the characters and the story as well as fiction, but it's definitely inspired by, well, some of the incidents that I've experienced, but also some of the people, both police officers, but also other civilians that I've either known or worked with throughout time.
That's fantastic. And thank you so much for agreeing to come on the podcast, Erik.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's no trouble at all. We're happy to get rid of Martin this week and have you on.
Yeah, sorry.
just so everyone knows, can you tell us a little bit about your experience as a police officer?
The short version was that I started in the Danish police school in 1991. In Denmark, we only have one police school covering the entire country. Well, actually, now we have two, but that's only about 2 years ago that we had two.
Oh, wow.
And I started in October 1st, 1991. So that's quite some time ago. And I had to work in the middle of the city of Copenhagen, actually the downtown part with all the bars and discos and all the nightlife was part of our precinct. And the other part was where a lot of the drug dealers and drug users hung out around the train station. Yeah. So that was my precinct, which was the smallest precinct actually at that time in Denmark, but also the precinct with the most arrests.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So I worked there as a regular, I maybe call it patrol officer. Just working in uniform, three shifts for, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. And then I went and worked with undercover drug investigation for 3 years, I think it was. And then I thought something else had to happen in my life. So I went and took the test for the School of Journalism in Denmark. And surprisingly, I got accepted. So from Copenhagen to Aarhus, which is also a little distance, I didn't think I would get accepted, but I did. So I thought, well, now I got to try and see what that's all about. And I lasted 2 years in journalism, and then I missed police too much. And I didn't really like the working conditions as a journalist. So I went back to the police. And back to working undercover with the drugs. And then I did that for a few more years. And then I worked as a detective for a year, no, 2 years. And then I worked some with crime prevention in the local schools where I was out telling about police work. And then I went to Kosovo for half a year as a bodyguard. UN work down there. Yeah. And
I suddenly feel very intimidated. you've had such an incredible career, and I'm so excited to get into
it. It's not really a career because I'm still just a regular officer, actually. I just done different kind of things. And for the last 15 years, on January 1st, I've been teaching at the police academy or police school as a use of force instructor.
Well, that's really interesting, and that's something that we want to come onto today. Actually, a bit of a kind of depressing topic, but we thought, as we've got your expertise on the show, we would like to kind of talk about some of the instances that have happened with the police over the last couple of years, and talk about, I guess, the erosion of public trust in the police as a kind of entity, at least in the US and the UK, we've seen very high profile cases that we're going to talk about in a little bit, and maybe get your thoughts on what's going on. But before we jump into our main topic this week, as always, we've got to discuss what we learned this week. Eric, you get a pass on this, unless you have a fact with you. But you're bringing your intense knowledge with you.
I was warned a little bit about what your whole idea is. So I actually come up with a fact. I visited my brother the other day, and he wanted me to have almond milk in my coffee. And for me, that was a fact that does not work. Either you drink coffee with the regular milk or you drink it without milk, not almond milk. That's what I learned this week so far. I'm sorry if you drink a lot of almond milk with your coffee, but to me it didn't work out.
No, I'm totally in agreement with you. My sister is vegan, and she at least used to drink a lot of almond milk, and she introduced me to almond milk in a similar way. It must be a sibling thing. Sisters and brothers introduce you to almond milk. And I remember I don't like almonds. Really don't. And I hate... You like almonds. Okay. Well, I don't like almonds, and I hate marzipan. Oh. And I didn't know that she had almond milk, and I went to her, stay with her for for breakfast in the morning. I had some cereal, and I had some coffee. And I just took a sip of the coffee. I was like, what is this? And I had a spoonful of cereal. I was like, why does everything taste like marzipan? What's going on? And then she got out of the fridge and was like, it's almond milk. And I was like, what? Why would you have a milk that makes everything taste like almonds? What is going on here?
So do you not have that as like a milk substitute in Denmark?
We got there's hardly any milk left because everything is a substitute for milk.
You got the milk, cashew milk,
milk.
And actually, my brother, he's not a vegan at all, so I was very surprised to find that kind of milk. But we got all kinds of different milk, and maybe some of them are all right in coffee. I don't know. But right now, the almond milk is not.
No, I 100% agree with you there. I agree entirely with that assessment.
Well, let us know, our listeners, what milk do you put in your coffee? And there's going to be some angry commenters right now.
Sorry,
pro almond milk. Oh, fantastic!
I don't mean to be a vegan. No,
Robin, what have you learned this week?
I learned a little bit of a historical fact. I don't know. It's kind of a sad topic, I guess, but it was Remembrance Day in the UK last month, Armistice Day, the 11th of November, for the celebration or the commemoration of the end of the First World War, and a tribute and commemoration, I guess, of everyone who has died in war, whether civilian or military. Do you celebrate on the same day?
No, not on that day. We have a day now which we got, I think, maybe 3 or 4 years ago. I think it's called the National Flag Day or something like that. And it's supposed to be a tribute to the police and mainly the military, lost soldiers in. Well, we haven't been in that many wars like you have, or at least not with the same intensity. But there's
it's a polite way of telling us that we're a terrible, terrible nation.
No, you helped us a lot, I'm sure. And I'm not thinking about the time you bombed us, but you helped us. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
This is the day where we celebrate the military, primarily for their doing in Afghanistan and whatever. But it's not the day. I'm not sure what day it is.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you celebrated, because over here what we do, there's a big event where the Queen leads a ceremony where notable figures and leaders of organizations and politicians place wreaths made of poppies on what we call the Cenotaph. It's a big monument in London. And it's, I don't know if you've seen it, but it's quite iconic. At least everyone in the UK knows about it because it's broadcast on TV every single year. And it's a big white stone monument. And I think it's quite beautiful. And I'm sure Alex has been there too. Yeah. I've walked past it a few times, and I think it's quite
beautiful. Was that where you can climb different... I don't know what you call it.
I mean, you could climb it. I don't think you... I don't think you're supposed to.
But no, you're not supposed to, but I was in London some years ago with my former wife and our kids. And my boy, he was climbing on something where he was running around on some big white thing.
It could be that.
It could possibly be that, I'm fair.
Yeah, there aren't many big white monuments that I can think of. That could be it. So you may have seen it then, in which case you'll know what I'm talking about. And it's a lovely monument. And it was created, wow. So here's the thing. It was created after the First World War as the centerpiece for this commemoration of the fallen. And I've always believed, and tell me if I'm wrong, Alex, I think most other people in the UK also believe, that monument has always been there since the end of the war. But I learned that it was actually originally a temporary wooden structure.
Really?
It was just put up in a hurry. As a temporary, it was supposed to be there just for a month or so. Mm. And millions of people came to see it and lay flowers and say prayers for their relatives who died. So many people came and they just kept on coming that after the time had expired that they were supposed to take this wooden structure down, they decided, oh, let's rebuild it in stone and make it permanent.
Which
explains
fantastic.
Why it's literally in the middle of the road. In a high, busy street in London. I've always wondered, like, why did they put it there?
Yeah, because why it wasn't... not in a park or something?
Yeah, in a park where people are going to gather naturally. Yeah, it's because it was meant to be just a temporary thing, just for a month or so, and then just people just kept on coming, so they replaced it with a permanent stone structure. And that's what I learned this week.
That's amazing. And honestly, though, I know you said, like, oh, people, I might have assumed that it was there forever, but looking at it, it looks so... fresh. Like I would believe that it was put up in the last few years, to be honest, if I hadn't already known of its existence.
Yeah, it's quite a dazzling white stone, I guess. And they keep it clean, I imagine, probably.
I imagine that's mainly what it is. Yeah.
That's probably what it is, yeah.
They clean it at least once a year.
At least. On November the 10th, just before they do the remembrance service. What did you learn this week, Alex?
So I learned this week that you know the Large Hadron Collider?
Yeah.
And I don't know if I vaguely remember this, but I remember a kind of running joke with this. But in 2009, the Large Hadron Collider had to be switched off and its main initial experiment that everyone was a little bit on edge about was postponed because they found a baguette inside it.
What?
They found a baguette inside the Large Hadron Collider that had caused it to overheat. And so they had to shut it down to find out what was going on. And they think that this was caused by a bird must have picked it up and dropped
what?
It. I don't know how.
No.
I don't know how this bit was exposed to the outside. But I mean, you hear that, don't you, about animals being inside of the Large Hadron Collider, like little mice running around in it.
But, I mean, that makes sense, but I hadn't thought about that. That must be tricky because the Hadron Collider goes on for miles. It's a big tube, isn't it? That goes on for miles and miles. And each time they conduct an experiment where they're throwing atoms and particles at each other over this course of miles, they must have to go through it and clear out all the rats and things that are just hiding in there and whatever. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, and a baguette apparently in 2009. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think it was a bird. I bet that's one of the scientists dropped their lunch and they're like, who put this baguette here? And it's like, that must have been a bird.
Flew in and dropped it. Yeah.
It was a bird.
the bird wouldn't drop the baguette. The bird would, definitely.
I mean, if the bird can lift the baguette, that bird is keeping the baguette.
Yeah. Exactly. And this became a kind of running joke, a kind of meme that time travelers were trying to stop them from switching on the Large Hadron Collider because this was just one of many like delays that the Large Hadron Collider had at the time, I think. And this one was just kind of like, okay, this has got to be a joke now. but yeah, no, I shouldn't say I learned that this week, but I was reminded of that this week. That was, I remember laughing at that years and years ago.
Oh, well, I hadn't heard that story at all, so thank you.
That's quite all right.
No, I haven't either.
Well, now that we've gotten that out of the way, shall we dive into our main topic of the week? But first, before we do, Eric, I was wondering if you could, and Robin can as well, can chime in, given that you did the audiobook.
I did.
But could you tell us a little bit about your book, Brutalization, and maybe just intrigue us, tantalize our listeners?
Nah. Well, that's for you to do, Robin.
Oh, okay. Well, here's the test of my knowledge. What I can say about this book, genuinely, is that it's good. And I really, sincerely enjoyed recording it. And in fact, I enjoyed it so much that I invited Eric to join us on the podcast because it was really, really good. And I think what really impressed me about it, Eric, and I hope I've interpreted the book correctly. There's a psychological element to it. You really get into the mind of the main character and trying to explain how a good person who's got good positive ambitions to become a policeman can very easily, but with the best intentions, go down the wrong path and become almost exactly what they want to stop, you know, kind of be corrupted, so to speak. But I feel like that's a slightly unfair word. It's more subtle than that. It's much more nuanced than that. And I genuinely, there's a phrase, psychological realism, that we use to describe characters in fiction. And genuinely, and I mean this with all my heart, I think you nailed that in the book really, really well. And there was a sense of realism to the whole thing that I think I asked you about it in an email, didn't I? I think I read it and I said, this is really convincing. These characters feel really real. How do you do it so well? And then you told me that you've been in the police force. And I was like, that's why everyone feels so real, because they're... I assume you've drawn from real life for a lot of the characters, and you've done it really, really, really well. The other thing I'd like to point out is that there's a character in there called Alex. And every time I read that chapter, I'm afraid I chuckled a bit, because I couldn't help but think of Alex, who we're sitting with now. And the character in the book doesn't have a particularly nice end. And I just kept imagining poor old Alex.
Are you thinking about are you talking about the main character?
No, not the main character.
Gotta be careful for spoilers here.
For spoilers, yeah. There's the celebrity they go and meet. That guy.
Well, I'm intrigued, and I think I need to know what you're talking about now, Robin. So I'm definitely gonna have a listen.
Definitely.
So all the Alices out there, they will be interested now.
hopefully they should be. They should be. That's great.
Yeah. Well, I would start out by saying thank you very much, Robin, for your kind words and also for doing the voiceover, the audio.
Well, thank you.
You just nailed your your analysis of the book, because what you just said was my point with that book, to try and make some characters that you as a reader would believe could be true. That was my main point. And actually the book started 12 years ago, maybe even longer. I watched the movie Training Day. I don't know if you watched the movie Training Day.
Yeah, it's a great film.
I think it's a great movie. The funny thing was, when the movie was over, I suddenly, for a reason that I don't know why it came, but it did come to me. When I watched the movie, I was thinking, could that happen in Denmark as well? And when I got that thought, and I'm not kidding you, I started thinking, no, probably not the way the movie was.
Right. But
definitely. The issue of the characters, what they were and what they became throughout the movie, especially one of them, what he turned into be. And for whatever reason, again, I started writing something down, which I've never, ever done before. I've never, ever thought that I would write a book, but I just started writing something down. The day after reading that, I thought, well, if that is going to happen, what I just wrote down the day before, then something must have happened before. Order for that to be logical.
Right.
And that was basically the start. And then suddenly I got so involved with the story that I had to put on more characters and more layers and blah, blah, blah. But that's how it started. And once again, Robin, I'm very glad that you got this this experience from reading the book, because that was my intention, that you would get to read about some characters. And actually another intention was that even though some of them are not very sympathetic or whatever, but basically, in my opinion, a lot of what's going on or happening in the book could happen to anybody. Depending on what circumstances they were in and the pressure they were under and stuff like that. That was my intention.
And I think you succeeded. And I'm really grateful that you asked me to record it for you, because it is genuinely a really good book. And I've done a few, and this was certainly the best. Certainly the best that I have done. I'm really grateful. I'm really pleased that you agreed to appear on the podcast to discuss. Yeah. And I would caution anyone who's interested in reading it or listening to the audiobook, if that's your thing. It's not what I'd call a fun book. It's an easy read, but it's not fun. If you're thinking it's going to be a barrel of laughs, there are some laughs in there, but
I mean, in fairness, Robin, our listeners are used to our podcast, so I'm sure they'll have no problem with that.
If they've got the taste for the darker side of things, then this is definitely a book for them. Yeah. And to be honest, also, it was a fascinating insight into Danish policing and how that whole system works, and Danish culture in general. I have to confess, I'm fairly ignorant when it comes to Danish culture, so that was nice. And thank you also, Eric, I want to say this publicly now, for your patience in tolerating my attempts at Danish words and names. It's not the easiest language to get right, and you were kindly said I got close, so thank you.
Good, excellent.
Robin's already started with the excuses, but I think everyone should listen to this book and go over to where was the link, Robin? Or is it the link will be in the description down below if you're watching on YouTube. Or alternatively, it will be on any major audiobook platforms of your choice. Fantastic. Shall we have a dive into the gritty world of policing over the last couple of years then? So I just wanted to kind of touch on the rising distrust, I guess, in police over the last couple of years. So starting last year, we saw protests across all 50 US states and in fact across the world. I remember the protest happening over here. I'm not sure if there are protests in Europe, but I'm sure there were anyway. In the wake of the George Floyd murder at the hands of then police officer Derek Chauvin. And whilst this tragedy was the catalyst of all of these protests that we saw across the world, I think it's pretty clear that this anti-police sentiment had been brewing for some time, and people saw this not just as an isolated incident, but an example of institutional racism and brutality within the police in America. And I think a lot of other countries kind of resonated with that as well. After all, the slogan from that time that we remember wasn't "lock up Chauvin" or "put away Derek." It was "Black Lives Matter" and "defund the police," which was one of the slogans that is widely remembered from that time. And interestingly, this is an interesting statistic and kind of a horrifying statistic I found out. A study from the National Academy of Sciences found that approximately 1 in every 1,000 black men can expect to be killed by police in the US.
Oh my gosh.
1 in 1,000. So that's a scary, scary fact.
Yeah. Isn't it that a black person is twice as more likely to be shot or killed by police in America than white people, based on the numbers as a proportion of the population. Mm-hmm. So I think because sometimes people like to spin the statistics and quite rightly point out that in America, the number of white people who are killed by police vastly outnumbers the number of black and other ethnic minority people who are killed by police. It's in the tens of thousands for white people, and it's in the just the thousands for black people. But as a proportion of the population, I think black Americans make up only about 13% of the population or something like that. Right. And it's quite shocking as a proportion of the population, the number of Black Americans killed by police is shockingly high. And like I said, it's twice as more likely to be killed. And like I said, one in a thousand can be expected to be killed by police in America.
I know. Yeah. I mean, it sounds unlikely, obviously, but I mean, you wouldn't. That's at the point where you wouldn't want to take those odds, really, if it's life and death. But I mean, this sentiment wasn't isolated to America, and this wasn't just an America thing. In the UK this year, we saw anti-police sentiment emerge in the wake of the murder of Sarah Everard, by then police officer Wayne Cousins. And for those of you who may not be aware of this case, she was walking home in South London when this man, who was a police officer, arrested her for allegedly breaching COVID rules. And then he kidnapped, raped, and murdered her. And I think, as horrific as the crime was, what really kind of enraged the public was the kind of failings of the Metropolitan Police that kind of led to the crime, or failed to prevent it from happening. And then their response to the public after the events. Yeah. So just as an example, leading up to the incident, this man, Wayne Cousins, he'd been accused in 2015 of indecent exposure, and had two other accusations of indecent exposure before that apparently had not been properly investigated. And in mid-October of this year, before this incident occurred, it was reported that police were investigating him, that he'd sexually assaulted a drag queen at a pub in Deal in 2018. Yet despite all of these accusations, he was still working as a police officer serving when the murder took place. And there are other things as well. Like his nickname that the police had for him, his colleagues had, they called him the rapist. I don't know if you were aware of that. That was like,
no, I was not aware of that.
That his colleagues had for him because of his the way that he creeped out women, apparently.
Right. Eric, is that could that just be innocent dark humor, so to speak, in the police context?
Yes, it probably could.
Yeah,
it probably could. But I'm not sure if I would call it innocent, because it usually there's something about it when people get. None of my colleagues, and I've never known anybody be nicknamed the rapist. So I haven't heard that. But you can have nicknames within the police, which are not very flattering. And if suddenly one of these persons that have a non-flattering nickname goes out and do something like what he does or something similar, then for sure you will wonder, but why did he have that nickname? Was that just an innocent nickname? Or was it actually because he did something wrong or had a bad behavior or abused his power or whatever it.
I agree. I think it's something that, like, it's not in good taste, but also I think it's more bad optics after the incident. Yeah. Like, I can imagine that just being a dark humor kind of nickname, but it doesn't look good when this all happened.
Either after way, the
especially yeah. talking about the public's opinion of the police.
Well, one of the things about the Sarah Everard case with this Wayne Cousins is that there she was killed on the 3rd of March, I think, and 10 days later on the 13th of March, there was a vigil held in Clapham Common, which is basically a big park, which is where she was killed, I think, or kidnapped, where she was kidnapped. She was taken away and killed elsewhere. And the police reaction to that caused a big controversy in the UK. And I think, broadly speaking, the way it went was there was an organization about women's rights and protecting women, particularly from violence, particularly perpetrated by men. And they organized this vigil. And a vigil is just a peaceful kind of expression of grief in a way and anger, but it's not a protest. It's not a demonstration. It was just people coming to, a lot of them just sit down.
Kate Middleton attended this.
Kate Middleton, yes, the Duchess of Cambridge. She popped up, and that's the kind of event it was. She went and stayed there for a little bit and then moved on. It was there for hours, went on all day on the 13th of March. But the organization that organized it were told by the police, I think just a few days before it was supposed to happen, that because of the COVID lockdown that we have in the UK, because of the restrictions about gatherings of large people, they said it was an illegal event. And the organizers tried to cooperate with the police and say, okay, can we do it in a way that obeys the regulations? Can we, you know, make people socially distance? If we guarantee that everyone's wearing masks, if we have any other kind of measures that we can take, can we do them? And they claim, the organizers claim, that the police ignored them and refused to cooperate in any way and just said, no, you can't have this vigil. Which is a peaceful event. Again, it's not a protest or anything. And on the day itself, as Alex said, it was so peaceful that even the Duchess of Cambridge herself, who's married to the next in line to the throne after Prince Charles, is turned up and everything was fine. But at the end of the day, in the evening, police officers essentially surrounded the crowd of people at the vigil and attempted to break it up. In fact, sorry, they did break it up. And they arrested only four people. But the images that arose from that were a bunch of mostly male police officers manhandling quite violently the majority of women on this vigil, to break up the crowd, and some images, two or three police officers arresting a woman. You know, she's on the ground and there's three officers piled on top of her to arrest her. So it looked really bad. It really did. But then there was an investigation, an official investigation, which concluded on the 30th of March. So this all happened within the space of 1 month, and the investigation found that the police had done nothing wrong, and they acted. Actually, I think the words they used were the police had acted in a measured way. They had given a measured response to the situation. And I think this is one thing I really want to ask you about, Eric. To us as non-police civilians, it looked really bad. It looked like a bunch of male police officers who were feeling bad about one of their own having committed this horrendous crime, just beating up essentially a bunch of women who are peacefully expressing their grief and anger and frustration with a society and the system that leaves them very vulnerable. But of course, legally, officially, they acted rightly. Is the action that the police took on that day, is that in a chime with the kind of training that you give and that you received in the Danish police force?
I must admit I haven't seen any of the either pictures or videos or whatever from that incident. But I think I know what you mean, because we have had similar incidents like in Denmark, just from another reason. Where there have been protests or demonstrations where the police will break up the demonstration or make an arrest or whatever. And I think it's kind of hard for me to say, because it can be that you have two or three police officers that are not using their force or their power rightfully. And therefore it looks violently, and it is violently, and they are behaving unprofessionally. But you can also have another perspective, and arresting just one person, even though it's a woman or whatever, can really be hard if that one person does not want to be arrested. And I have tried this myself plenty of times with even like smaller kids, 15 or 16 year old, even girls, where you would say that one grown man should be enough to control that girl, for instance. But if she's very, very mad and very, very upset, it's very, very hard to have a controlled arrest of that person. In some cases, you end up using much more force, and it becomes much more violent, because it's very hard to control a person where the arms and legs are swinging, and you have to make sure that you don't get hurt yourself, and you have to make sure that you use as little force as possible to control that person. And sometimes that's why you see either sometimes two or three like big police officers, males controlling one female. And I'm not talking about the incident in England because I don't know anything about that. But the perspective or the rationale is actually that it's going to be as less violent as possible. So if you have like two grown-ups, each controlling an arm of that person, and you have a third one controlling the legs, for instance, that means that that person, that 16-year-old girl who's very upset about whatever, and maybe she's on drugs or whatever, she can't use her arms and legs to harm anybody. Mm. But yeah. Taking that picture in that split second of those three big males taking her down can look very violent, but it might not be violent at all. That can also be the reason, but you could also have three police officers who just like to take down people violently, and then the motive will be totally different.
How do you know when that line has been crossed, though?
You don't necessarily know, but like within the police, you can either have the nicknames like the rapists, or you can have, you know, there are some of your colleagues, some of the police officers that would do quite a bit to get the conflict or to get the action more than others would do. So if, like, for instance, me as a police officer, if I would see a picture in the newspaper the day after of three police officers taking down one person, and I would know these three persons, these police officers, as some of the types that would like to have the action, I could have my thoughts about what their motive would be to do it in that way. But I could also see three different kind of male police officers, which I would know as very calm persons and professional police officers. And I would maybe even see the same picture just with three different police officers. And my thoughts about the action would be totally different. That's one thing. Another thing is the leadership of the police, you know, who do they put out to do what kind of things? Do they send out some of the guys that are known within the forces being some of those who like the action part? Do they put them out as the first front officers to close down a demonstration with all these women? Mm. Would that be a good idea or not? Probably not.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, you're absolutely right to bring up the leadership in this, and it was the leadership of the Metropolitan Police, Cressida Dick. Who received a lot of the kind of criticism surrounding this incident, and there are actually calls for her resignation. I think it's hard to kind of separate. It's not just like the images, but it was also the kind of the original reasoning for shutting it down due to like the COVID restrictions. As many people kind of pointed out, the police's reaction to other protests that were going on at that time, like large gatherings of anti-mask protesters in Trafalgar Square, you know, just weeks earlier to this, and the police, you know, wouldn't shut that down, for example. It was hard to ignore like the feeling that this was personal for them in some way, like this was an anti-police demonstration and so it would be shut down. That was the kind of impression that I think was given to a lot of people anyway.
I would be very, very surprised if the British officers, I don't think that very many of them, if either any of them, sympathize with that guy. So I have a hard time seeing their motive to go out and being very violent against some women because their colleague has turned out to be a rapist and a killer. I just don't really believe it.
I think that is something that's lost in these kind of in like the media fallout that came from this event, is that everyone is just a person, you know. The police are just people at the end of the day, and quite rightly the vast majority of them are going to have absolutely no sympathy for Wayne Cousins. I fully agree with that. I think it was just the impression that was given from this event was very much that.
But it's ironic, isn't it, that the very first female commissioner of the Metropolitan Police should be the one who handles, frankly, very badly this incident where a male police officer has murdered horrifically a young woman, and then consequently police officers have been perceived to be excessively using excessive force against female demonstrators or vigilance, yeah. I should say. Yeah. It's just, there's an irony there.
I'm interested though in, did you receive training? I'm guessing you did in like protests and scenarios, and whether that was like different instances, and whether it was good to, you know, let a protest run its course, or what was the kind of deciding factor in having to shut a protest down or de-escalate it in some way? Because I like to think the best in these situations. Yeah. And there were reasons why this protest was shut down, and that, you know, anti-mask protests just weeks earlier were left to run its course. But then, you know, how would they shut that anti-mask protest down without there being excessive violence, I guess? Yeah, what kind of training did you get on reading situations like that? That's a pretty vague question, I know.
Well, actually, as a main regular police officer or patrol officer, I've been to demonstrations as well. But we're just out there in our uniform, holding a line or whatever, doing whatever we are being told. And I can say, like, in a Danish context, probably pretty similar to the British, you have the right to demonstrate, of course. And when you want to make a demonstration, you apply to make the demonstration, and you tell under what conditions you have this demonstration, from what time to what time, and which route are they going to use to walk or stuff like that. And then they get the permission. And then I'm not sure if it's like this, but if they do something illegally, if they start throwing bottles from the demonstration, which sometimes happening because people get drunk, it's mainly because people are drunk. If nobody were drunk, it would be a crime actually. And it's especially in these demonstrations. So if they start throwing bottles, or if they start before all this COVID, where it was, at least in Denmark, you weren't allowed to wear a mask. To hide yourself. So if they did that during the demonstration, the police officer or the police chief in charge would usually get in contact with the organizer of the demonstration and tell the organizer, if you don't stop throwing bottles, or if you don't take off the masks, or whatever the reason might be, we are going to stop the demonstration and you can't demonstrate anymore. And some of the organizers, as far as I'm aware, they are actually pretty reasonable, and they, at least what I know, they try to stop these usually few people who ruin it for the rest, but they can't. Usually they can't, because they are drunk and they don't care what they say. And some of them, they just want the conflict with the police.
Yeah, of course.
And if that's the case, and they keep throwing bottles, or they don't take off their masks or whatever, then the police will say, well, now the protests or the demonstration is over. And if they don't follow that order, well, then you can use force to end the demonstration. And usually it looks very violently, because the police usually have riot gear on. And then you have these people who are maybe masked, and they get in a big clinch. And it looks very violently, and sometimes it also is.
Do you think the riot gear can be provocative? For instance, in the Sarah Everard vigil, the police weren't wearing riot gear, which I think is something that's worth pointing out to the people who criticise the way the police behaved. They weren't. No. They didn't go there prepared to have a fight. They went there as normal police officers in high-vis jackets.
Yeah.
But do you think, well, I suspect anyway, and maybe you can confirm this, if I were a drunk person being rowdy at a rally, or if I were not even drunk, but I was angry at some kind of protest, and the police turn around the corner and there's 10 of them with shields and helmets on, I'm going to take a bottle and smash it over their heads, you know, because they can take it, because they're all armored. Yeah. Whereas if they weren't armored, if they didn't have the shields, and if they were just open-faced, no helmets, then I'd probably be like, you know, I'd recognize the human being in the uniform, and I wouldn't react violently.
Yeah.
This is the hypothetical me. This isn't actually me. This is the the hypothetical Robin.
You would see 10 police officers in full riot gear and be like, I'm going to smash one of them over the head with a bottle. I don't think you'd do that, Robin.
Well, real me, no. But I'm saying if I were angry, if I were in the mood...
It's dehumanizing, yeah. I guess. Is that...
That's what I'm guessing at, I suppose. Is it, Eric, in your experience, in your opinion, is it?
Yeah.
Do you think it can provoke a reaction?
Yeah, but I would also say that in my experience, no sane, non-drunk, a person not under the influence of drugs would never do that. They are usually drunk and or under the influence of a typical cocaine or something like that. That's when they do those totally stupid things that don't make sense. But I would say that I agree on the riot gear can be provocative. And in Denmark, actually, for that reason, we have, we've got more than two football clubs, but we have got especially two clubs in Copenhagen that have like the firm that they do in Scotland.
Alex is in the firm, aren't you, Alex?
Sorry?
No, I'm not.
No, but whenever these two clubs meet, they have their fans or hooligans or whatever, or criminals that have used football as an excuse to be a criminal, my opinion. And when you have these games, you have all these fans, and the majority of the people are just fans. And then you have the minority who just want to fight each other. Then you have the police in just regular uniform and with some vests, but not riot gear. And for that reason, as you just said, Robin, not to provoke anything. So you just have, they're called dialogue officers, actually.
Oh.
And they're just there to keep the tensions down and talk to them. And if somebody's about to do something very stupid, just go over and like put a hand on his or her shoulder for that reason, or for that matter, and to just cool it. And maybe some of the other fans will assist not to do the stupid thing. Because around the demonstration, but not visible, you have the riot police. So if something goes wrong, they come in, but they are not visible. And usually that works pretty good. It doesn't always work, but I think the principle is a very good principle. And I think the reason is what you just said, Robin, that when you have the riot gear visible, it's much more an invitation for a fight.
That's this contrasts a lot with what's been happening in America recently, with the kind of militarization, you could say, of many police departments. I watched a segment a while ago on something, and the kind of budgets that local police departments get in America can be insane. I think one of them in Dallas had like a budget of $196 million. Just looking at like some of the equipment that they have available, they've got like tanks and or like military vehicles to spray people with tear gas and rubber bullets. And
don't the American police, most American police, I should say, because it varies from state to state and county to county and district to district, don't they have like discounts on surplus army gear? Isn't that a thing they do? Like when the army's getting rid of stuff, they sell it to the police essentially, and the police get a discount. So it just encourages them to buy more military gear, like actually stuff that was designed for the army to kill other people. And you think, why is the police getting that stuff?
Do you think, it's maybe a little bit of a different point, but do you think it's something about, in America in particular, but definitely over here and maybe in Denmark as well, do you think the media gives the wrong idea of people when they're going into the police? So like in America, you've got all these kind of action hero films, you know, everyone loves a renegade cop who's doesn't play by the rules, but by Christ, he gets results. Do you think that kind of like all the diehards have kind of given the wrong idea of what being a police officer is about?
Yeah, I definitely think that there's that Hollywood effect in the States. And I think in a smaller scale, you can you can have it in Denmark as well. A few years ago, you could hardly open the TV or turn on the TV without watching some kind of police program, and not a movie, but journalists following police cars, being on patrol and whatever they were called, all these programs. And of course, they are not filming when you are sitting writing on the report on the computer. They are filming all the sirens and all the action. So it's a lot of free publicity for the police. And we could see that on the academy, you know, when all these programs were going on. We had no problem in getting appliers for the police education.
That's really interesting.
And I'm sure that quite a few of them are getting pretty disappointed when they find out that work is not only what they see on TV. But that being said, I don't think it's, and I don't know actually what the different motives for the Americans to apply for the police, but I think in general, the difference between England, Denmark, maybe Europe in general, and the US, they have a totally different culture on guns and military and a little bit on competition in general. You have to win. And their rhetoric, either you're with us or you're against us, it's not as much, I would say, the dialogue perspective. I'm sure that many of I worked with some of the Americans in Kosovo. Great officers, great police officers, but some of them were also actually like a small story. The bodyguard unit I was in was run by Americans, and they were very, very nice people. But their perspective on actually our point at that time in Kosovo was to build up Kosovo as a state. So we had to assist with the policing, and so that's why you had the UN and you had police officers from all over the world doing all kinds of police job. And mine was just being at that bodyguard squad. But the American perspective, at least from my knowledge and my experience, was that it was to be seen like a military operation. So during my training, the 9 days bodyguard training, we were shooting all the time. Really? Out of the car, under the car, out of the window, and calling for helicopters. And it was, in my opinion, and in a Danish opinion, it was totally crazy.
Yeah.
And it was, in my opinion, much more, they had a much more military perspective on this assignment, where I and some of my other colleagues that I talked to, we saw this building up Kosovo as a nation much more as, well, we were supposed to be a police and have a police perspective and not with a military perspective, where we saw the others as enemies. Whereas the Americans running this were much more either you're a friend or you're an enemy.
Right.
And actually what I also realized was the big difference in the US between police forces. In the northern states, from what I was told and the guys I talked to, they had a salary which was pretty good and pretty similar to like a police officer in Denmark. Whereas in the southern states, the salary was much, much lower. So many of the police officers from the southern states, they had to have another job. They were working as a doorman or whatever places.
Wow.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was actually really interesting in finding out what is this all about. And many of the southern police officers, they came directly from the military. So before they became a police officer, they had been maybe 10 years in the military. And then some sheriff in some county or however the structure was got elected. And then the sheriff, he decides who he wants to have as police officers. And so you might have, let's say you need 20 police officers and you have 20 guys signing up from the military. Well, then they will be the police officers from that county until they elect a new sheriff. And maybe the new sheriff want 20 different police officers. So you just fire them and get his own.
What?
It was I had no idea about that structure, and I might not get it all right now. I'm sorry if I'm saying something that's not totally right. But in general...
Oh, don't worry. We do it all the time.
And the southern states. And the southern states, from my experience, were much more... they had much more the military mindset, because many of them came directly from the military, and then they were police officers, and then they might go back to the military. Or that was my experience.
Really interesting.
That's really interesting. And particularly interesting because, sorry, Alex, I was just... You were saying that, I had flashbacks. I was looking at earlier a map of someone had plotted all the known police killings over the last 10 years on the map of the US states. Mm-hmm. And the distribution is fascinating because, quite surprising, but in the northern states, obviously the police killings are concentrated in the cities, big cities, Chicago, New York, that's what you'd expect. And then all the other killings outside of California, which has a shocking amount of killings actually by police, it's just the southern states, and it's just all over them. There's no real, I mean, there is a slightly bigger concentration of police killings in the cities like Atlanta, you know, obviously it's going to be slightly higher in the cities where there's more crime and gangs and things, but there's a big difference where you've got these big swathes of emptiness in the northern states outside the big cities, and then in the southern states there's just police killings mapped all over. So that's really interesting, because that seems to chime almost exactly with this attitude difference that they seem to have between the northern and the southern states.
Maybe I didn't know that, but it's interesting.
I was actually looking up earlier about like police training in America anyway, and I came across something called warrior cop training. Have either of you heard of that? So there's
I actually heard about it.
So there was a prominent police trainer in America that goes around to different precincts in different states giving this course, and it's an incredibly popular course. Basically training police people to have like a killer's instinct and to be a predator. They literally say that, a predator.
I know that the predator is the bad guy in the films, right? Arnold Schwarzenegger kills the predator. They know that, right? Sorry, interrupted.
Yeah, but Arnold Schwarzenegger, the Democrat.
Dave Grossman is his name, this instructor who runs this course in a pseudo-academic field called killology, he calls it. Killology. It's about instilling in the people that take this course the emotional mindset of taking a life, basically, and training them to be a warrior. I think a lot of this is just kind of people are kind of questioning what the role of the police actually should be in society. Do you want a bunch of self-described predators walking around? I'm guessing not.
Well, actually, right now I'm teaching in exactly that kind of thing, because I'm teaching in the use of force. What I'm teaching is use of force and conflict handling. So that's what I've been teaching the last 15 years.
Wow.
And I can see both sides. And we make quite an effort on telling the students to de-escalate the system or the situations and how to do it and be aware of that. But you also have to teach them what to do if de-escalation or de-escalation or whatever it's called is not sufficient, because it doesn't always work. And especially not on people who are very drunk or who are under the influence of drugs or who are just mentally ill. We get more and more cases where we have to deal with mentally ill persons, which we are in no way educated at doing, but they end up just being the police job because nobody else is taking care of them when they go crazy somewhere with a knife or whatever. We also have an obligation to tell the officers or the police officers how to defend themselves and how to defend their colleague and how to defend the public and how to take down a person if somebody is killing somebody else or is at risk doing it. So it's a very, very fine line, being calm and being de-escalating, but also mentally being aware that in one split second, this situation might be that I have to draw my gun. The police are carrying guns. I might have to draw my gun and shoot that person, for instance. It might sound hard theoretically to understand, but it's 10,000 times harder to do it in real life because you mentally have to be two very, very, very different places. So it's a very, very hard thing to do. But in my opinion, having something called a warrior course or whatever it's called is definitely not going to help. I think.
Yeah, because the branding will appeal to a certain kind of person. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And mentally, they will, in my opinion, directly go to the predator perspective because that's what they're trained to do.
If you think of yourself as a predator, then you're kind of primed to think of everyone else as prey.
Or you just see the others as enemies. Like I was saying before, you categorize it by either you're with us or you're against us. We're friends, and if we're not friends, you're the enemy. And you know what you do to the enemy. You take out the enemy. And again, that's the military perspective on things.
Well, America is very famous. I'd say probably the most famous police action ever taken in America is the war on drugs.
Yeah.
Right, and just the word they're using, it's a war on drugs.
Yeah.
And it feels like every election they talk about the war on crime, things like that. And obviously the same terminology is used for, say, the war on poverty or whatever. But the fact that they gravitate towards using that word war automatically makes it a much more higher, more aggressive situation than it necessarily need be. And it's interesting as well that you talked about the mental health problem in terms of Danish police having to deal with people with mental health problems, but you don't have the training to deal with mental health problems, but you nonetheless have to train yourselves to deal with mentally ill people. Because that's a big criticism of the American police force, in that every year goes by and they get more and more responsibilities dumped on them. And one thing is that in America, this is what's reported anyway, is that the police are the first port of call to deal with people who have mental health problems instead of getting doctors and psychiatrists and therapists, people who are trained to deal with them.
Yeah.
To go and try and to deal with these situations. If someone's having a mental breakdown and looks like they might be violent, the police get involved straight away and they're the first people to deal with it rather than perhaps a therapist and some kind of negotiator, like a hostage negotiator, could come instead and try to talk them out of it or find out what's wrong.
Yeah.
And there's a theory amongst activists, at least, that because the American police are often involved in these situations that could be better handled by a qualified professional in a different field. As we just talked about the riot gear, the police merely by turning up escalate the situation. Even if their intention is to de-escalate it, they end up escalating it because this person who's highly strung and having a really bad time sees the police turning up and suddenly, I mean, to use a perhaps inappropriate analogy, it's like that moment in Grand Theft Auto when you're playing a video game and you're just going down the street and then you accidentally run someone over and then suddenly the police sirens and that big sign flashes up, wanted. And within minutes, your video game has turned into a rampage and you're killing police everywhere. And it's just because you're just stressed, right? Whereas all you were doing was casually driving and that darn pedestrian got in the way. That's a terrible and possibly inappropriate analogy. I appreciate this.
But, possibly.
But I'm just saying, anyone who's played that game knows that feeling of escalation where the police turn up and it's escalated.
I haven't played the game, so...
if you don't mind mentioning your book again, Eric, you use that term warrior a lot in the book. The characters use it to each other a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So it's you explore that attitude and that problem, at least in the Danish context.
As you know, Robin, because you read the warrior is also part of the past of one of the main characters. But the nickname for one of the main characters also make him feel more macho.
Yeah.
More like the man he wants to be. I definitely recognize the what kind of rhetoric or what kind of language you use, what the effect can be on either your approach on things or how it's being dealt with in a professional manner.
So what do you think of the Derek Chauvin case where he was kneeling on George Floyd's neck for 9 minutes until George Floyd died?
Yeah.
From your police perspective, how did you see that? What was your reaction when you saw that news?
My reaction was, of course, it was a tragic incident and a tragic outcome. But when I saw it, first of all, it looked unprofessional to me. Basically, what he was doing, if we can just separate some of the parts, basically what he was doing to control him, to hold him down. And I'm not saying if it was the best thing to do or if it was even necessary or anything. I'm just saying that that technique used to hold him down could basically be a good technique to hold somebody down. Actually, we use it in the Danish police force as well, where you put one knee, you don't put it on the neck. Mm. You put it on top of your back and the other knee down here by the spine. And then the whole idea is, and then you have the person's arm in between your legs. And the main idea is that you can control that person, and then you put handcuffs on the person, and then you turn the person from the prone position up either on the side, or you make them sit up, or you make them stand up so they can breathe easier or more easily. But you don't put your knee on the neck. And that was the first thing I noticed when I saw what he was doing. I saw that he was doing it wrong and it was unprofessional what he did. Another thing which I saw and which affected me in seeing it was his attitude at what he was doing was like, didn't matter. Yeah. And he didn't care what people around him were saying because nobody was going to tell him what to do. He was the one in charge here. And he was the one who made the calls. And to me, that was an arrogant and an unprofessional way of solving that problem, whether it was necessary or not, even to do that. But in my opinion, he could have used that technique if he had used it correctly. And if he had just handcuffed the guy and put him in a position where he had been easy to or been able to breathe. Well, it was stupid, unprofessional police work.
So how do you achieve the trade-off though? Because in a perfect world, I think everybody could agree, I hope, that people like Derek Chauvin should not be in the police force. If that's his attitude, if he's unprofessional and arrogant, obviously unintentionally or not a murderer, those people, we don't want them in the police force because that's not what the police force needs. But the police force also, like any business, I guess, even if it's state-funded or not, needs people. It needs to have people populating the roles. If somebody is in the role, you need that physical body there because it's a very physical thing to do. You can't automate policing. You can't get computers to replace policemen. They've got to be there to arrest criminals and to calm situations down and to control potential riot situations and civil unrest. How do you achieve that? How do you get rid of the people you don't want to be in the police force, but also keep the numbers up?
Yeah. I don't have the solution for that. I think the more you talk about it, the more you put it out in the open, what's right and what's not right, I think we'll eliminate, and actually it's a little bit about what my book is also about, where you have this minority of, for instance, police officers, like you have in all kinds of different kinds of work. But within the police, you have a minority who are not, who never should have been police officers and who are unprofessional. And some of them use too much violence. Some of them are just unprofessional in other ways and are not suited for the job for other reasons. But if we stick to the violent part, the problem can sometimes be that some of these persons. They are often very macho, and they are like the alpha male type. Mm. And in my opinion, if you don't have a strong leadership to take control of these kind of persons and either make sure that they don't get out on the street or they get fired or whatever, it's very, very hard to do anything about, because the normal regular patrol officer who rank-wise is leveled with this, Derek Chauvin, for instance, it's very hard for just the regular patrol officer to do anything about a guy like him. You might do everything you can not to patrol with that guy or be on the same shift or whatever, but in my opinion, if you start telling, for instance, the leaders about this guy, and you tell them, well, we don't want him and he's too violent and he's too aggressive or whatever, very often nothing happens. And you get the risk of being seen as illoyal, somebody you can't trust or whatever. So I think what you need here is the education. You have a lot of focus on what's right and what's not right. And you have a lot of focus on, that's what we're trying to do, put a lot of focus on, the reflection part. Are you familiar with the term called UDA? Do you know anything about that?
UDA is a way of
it's a mental, if I explain this right, I'm sorry if my English is but it's a mental approach on how to deal with problems, for instance. And it's OODA, and the letters means observation, orientation, decision, and action. If you get involved, like, for instance, as a police officer in some kind of conflict, let's just say that I'm going and I make an arrest of somebody and we start struggling. I make the observation. Okay, I can take this down. I think I'll be strong enough. I make my orientation. Okay, we can do this. It's out in the open. Nobody's going to fall down in stairs or whatever. And then the D, I decide that I'm going to take this guy down. And then I do my action. I start taking him down, for instance, for an arrest. But let's say that during this arrest, the guy pulls a knife. My OODA loop perfectly should be running all the time. So instead of just being in the same loop where I'm sticking to my same kind of action, mm-hmm. taking him down, if the guy suddenly draws a knife, my OODA loop should tell me, new observation, I see he has a knife, new orientation, he's got it in his hand, it's close to me. I have to make a new decision. I have to either push the guy away or I have to get away, because now suddenly he can stab me with that knife. So I have to make a new action. I don't know if that makes sense to you. But that kind of mental approach should be going on all the time. So just because I start out with one decision and one action, and then I'm going to follow through no matter what else happens. We try to teach them not to do that, or at least be aware that the situation might change, which might cause that you have to change your action as well. And like in the Derek Chauvin case, in my opinion, if he had been more aware of that kind of mental approach, he would have been much more, in my opinion, willing to realize that something was not going right here. I have to change my action. I have to do something else because this is not right. But in my opinion, he was so focused on that he had made the first decision, the first action to take him down, and he was going to sit on him no matter who said what, no matter what happened. So he was not going to change. I've said A, so I'm going to say B, and I'm not going to change that. And we're trying to teach the students, well, you might have to say C instead of B, and you might have to go back to A, and then you go to B again or to F or whatever. I hope it makes sense. Because it's a good tool to be aware that you might have to change your mind, and you might end up doing something that you, from the start, had no intention or no idea of doing. And it doesn't mean that you have lost the fight or anything. It just means that you are smart, and you're smarter than the other. And I think that the more, at least that's my opinion, that's what I try to do, the more I can tell my students about this, and not make them feel that they lose the fight just because they do something else or whatever. I think that's what you can do from an educational point. And then a lot of it is about leadership.
That's really fantastic insight. That's very interesting and kind of giving us an insight into how your training works and what you're trying to teach and instill in your students. Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah.
Have you heard the English phrase, he who fights and runs away lives to fight another day?
No.
Yeah, it's a good phrase. You just reminded me of that as you were describing Uda. Because I guess it sounds like Uda is a good process because it trains you to be constantly evaluating a situation so that you don't make up your mind before you even got there what you're going to do. No. And it validates equally seeking a potentially violent solution to a situation if it gets that bad, but also seeking a solution where you run away and live to fight another day if it gets to that kind of situation. That's good. I like that approach. I'll try using that technique in my own life when I go into the kitchen to do the washing up. The situation's changing.
Mental approach, mental awareness. And it was actually made up by some American fighter pilot during the Second World War or after Second World War. For him to continuously be one step ahead of the enemy. Because the enemy or whoever also has some kind of OODA loop. But if you're not aware of your OODA loop, it's just whatever you feel like doing or what you're accidentally doing or whatever. So if I'm fighting somebody to arrest the person is also doing some kind of OODA loop, but they might not be aware of it. Mm. So me being aware of my OODA loop, it's like a game of chess where I'm always ahead of the opponent's approach.
That's well, so Robin, when you encounter 10 police in riot gear and you've made the decision to glass one of them over the head, do the OODA loop in your head again.
Yep.
And reassess that.
Yeah, reassess the situation. Advice. And maybe I'll come up with a different action. Or maybe I'll...
That depends on how drunk you are.
True.
True. Eric, thank you so much for your insights in this discussion. It was quite a heavy discussion and unsurprised. Well, I mean, I'm very surprised that we haven't gotten to the bottom of all of the police like woes and found solutions for everything on this podcast. But how would you both like to do a quiz?
I would love to do a quiz.
In Danish.
I'm afraid it's not in Danish. Welcome, both of you, to this week's quiz. Robin, you're up against Eric in the quiz this week. And not to alarm you, but all of them are police-related. No, they're not. Don't worry. No, this quiz, there's 10 questions, as always, plus a bonus question if we need it, but we might do it anyway. And I just thought of... So I was going for like a 2021 theme. But then it kind of devolved into just general knowledge towards the end. So a lot of them are events that have happened this year.
Okay, so it's things you might have seen in the news.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Possibly. At least for the first half of the quiz.
Right.
So, but before we begin, we need to hear your buzzers. So, Robin, what's your buzzer this week?
Well, I've taken this opportunity whilst Alex is being the quiz master to choose Alex's favourite buzzer, which is...
Champagne.
There we go.
Drunk Orson Welles.
And Eric, do you have a buzzer with you today?
I have a Christmas song. Let's see if I can.
I'm feeling festive.
That's lovely.
Yep.
This is the weirdest quiz ever. It's mixed between Drunk Orson Welles and a Christmas Carol. Lovely. Yep. Okay, question number one. In January 2021, protests took place at which US national building? I hear your buzzer. Eric, which building was it? It was Capitol Hill, yes. Point to you.
You threw me with the wording of the question. I was like, National Building? What is he talking about? It's like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, Congress, that place where all the stuff happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, let's see if you remember this one. Question number two. In March, we saw the Suez Canal blocked for days, causing severe trade delays around the world. What was the name of the ship that caused it? Do you remember this? Did you see this happening on the news?
It was a big ship shipping container tanker that got lodged sideways across the Suez Canal. Yeah. And in the end, and there was that great picture of it was stuck in the sandbanks, and it was this giant ship and this very small digger on the bank trying to dig it out. It was a hilarious picture. And it was called something kind of odd, I think. Was it the...
I can't remember. 102, take two.
Go on then, Robin.
Was it the Queen something? It's called like the Queen...
I'm afraid not. It was not the Queen something.
Okay.
I don't even know how to give you a clue for this one, to be honest. I may just have to give it to you.
I can't remember.
Did you want to have a guess, Eric, or are you...
I have no idea.
You're good. So this was the Ever Given, it was called.
Oh, right. Yes.
Bit of a difficult name to remember.
Actually, you're right. You couldn't really give a clue for that, could you?
No. Okay. Question number three. 1-0 to Eric still.
Meh.
In April of this year, the 1 billionth vaccine was delivered, but over half of those had been delivered to which three countries? So I need three countries in this answer.
In April.
The French champagne.
I think I heard Orson there. I think I heard Orson first.
Okay.
Boom, Robin.
I'm going to optimistically say the UK was one of those three countries that had got ahead with the vaccine program. And now I'm stumped.
Do you know what? I'll stop you there. You're wrong. So,
no, really? Really?
Yeah. Yep. The UK was not one of them.
Oh.
Then I can take it.
Yep.
Yeah. The US?
Yeah.
Yeah. Israel? Is that right?
I'm afraid Israel is not right now.
Oh. No.
But they were really, they did really well, Israel. They were ahead. Yeah.
So I give you both a clue. So this is over half of a billion vaccines were delivered to these three countries. So these are the big countries.
Ah.
Yep. Go for it, Eric.
India and China.
You said the US, didn't you?
Yeah, you said the US. Yeah.
That is correct. It's the big boys. Yeah.
So even though America has the reputation for being really behind on the vaccines and people not taking it up, they actually were ahead of the game by April.
Well, I mean, I guess they had. I think this was just about numbers mainly. Like,
yeah, they have a lot of people
had,
there.
They had a lot of people. all three of these countries.
Yeah.
Okay, so that is 2-0 to Eric.
Darn it.
As we go on to question four. In June of this year, the Juno spacecraft performed the first flypast of Ganymede in over 20 years. Ganymede is a moon of which planet?
It's always been celebrated for its excellence.
Yes, Robin.
Jupiter?
It is Jupiter.
Oh, okay.
Well done.
Good one.
Well, it has the most moons, so it seemed like a safe bet.
Fair enough. Well, that's well reasoned. Okay, 2-1 to Eric still as we go on to question five. Which country recently became a republic on the 55th anniversary of its independence?
There's a California champagne by Paul Masson.
Yes, Robin.
If I'm correct, I feel like I do have a home advantage given it was a Commonwealth nation and has just become a republic. Barbados.
It was Barbados, yeah. Barbados. We may have had a bit of an advantage on that one.
We used to rule it.
Yeah.
And now the British Empire will never be the same without Barbados.
Okay. That's two all as we move on to question number six. Greenland is an autonomous territory of which country?
Oh, I got that one. Oh, how is that? Yeah.
Yeah, Sarah.
I think it's Denmark, actually.
It is Denmark, yes. Yeah. Greenland is a part of the Kingdom of Denmark, which we actually, I know that you should know this, Robin, because we spoke about this years and years ago.
When wasn't Trump was going to buy Greenland from Denmark?
He was
right?
trying to buy Greenland.
Yeah.
I don't know if any offers were made, but
I don't think they got that far.
No.
The story was that he should have come and visited Denmark, and it's very rare that the American president visits Denmark, but he should have come to Denmark, and then there was this talk about he wanted to buy Greenland, and the prime minister of Denmark politely said no, I suppose, and then he didn't come after all. So... Yeah. Suddenly he didn't show up.
That doesn't sound like him.
No. I'm very surprised. Yeah, I'm very offended. Yeah.
Okay. Question number seven. That's 3-2 to you, Eric. Okay. English astronomer John Couch Adams discovered which planet in 1846? Multiple planet questions in this quiz. Yeah. Apologies for that.
John Couch Adams.
Discovered which planet in 1846?
1846.
Inspired by that same French Exodus.
Well, Pluto was discovered in the 1930s, I believe. So it's not Pluto. What comes before Pluto? Is it Neptune? Neptune.
Is that your guess?
That's my guess.
It was Neptune, yeah.
Hey.
The eighth planet from the sun.
Very good, Robin.
Thank you. Well, yeah. I mean, I know some things about outside our planet, and on our planet, I'm very clueless.
Well done. Okay, three all. Question number eight. Okay. Stephanie Kwolek, a scientist born in America in 1923, was best known for inventing which strong, heat-resistant synthetic fiber?
What?
It's an in-depth question, I know. Yeah, this is a tough question.
Heat-resistant synthetic fiber.
You may have to have a guess on this one.
It's going to be a wild stab in the dark, I think.
So I repeat it. So Stephanie Kwolek, a scientist born in America in 1923, was best known for inventing which strong, heat-resistant synthetic fiber?
Okay.
I can give you both a clue for this one.
That might be necessary for me. I don't know about you, Eric. I think I need a clue.
Well, from my limited understanding, I'm guessing the police use this quite a lot.
Yeah.
This material.
Yeah, I think you're right. I just can't think of what it's called.
Wait, are these synthetic fibers? What?
I just have a guess. I don't know if it's... Thermo?
It's not thermo. No.
I'm genuinely clueless.
It's fermented in the bottle and like...
It can't be this. Asbestos.
It's not asbestos, no.
Yeah, okay. That gives you cancer, doesn't it?
Should I tell you what it... I don't know if I can give you a clue on the name, but should I tell you what the letter that it starts with?
Would
that
be? Sure.
So it starts with K. This material. You will have both definitely heard of it.
Yeah.
The best French champagne. It's...
Yes, Robin?
This is bulletproof Kevlar?
It's Kevlar, yeah.
Whoa. Oh, Kevlar's heat resistant. I did not know that.
No, I didn't either.
Well, now you know.
Yeah.
We're learning new things on this podcast.
Yeah. But they use it in bulletproof vests, don't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Wow. Okay.
So what's that? Robin, I think you've made a comeback. Is that 4-3?
Sorry, Eric.
Yeah.
Question number nine. In which city will the Olympic Summer Games of 2024 take place?
The next Olympic Games.
Seems so far away now, doesn't it?
We've just had the last ones, haven't we? In Japan. Tokyo, yeah. Tokyo, yes. Mm-hmm. And the next
one. Yeah, and they were 2020, but they were actually this year. Because of COVID.
I think I might know it. Yeah. In Paris?
It is Paris, yeah.
Oh, right.
Huh. Are you planning on going?
No, not really. At least they ask me nicely.
Fair enough. Okay, so that's four all as we move on to question number 10.
The final question.
Yeah.
And this will test how much both of you have been paying attention to TV this year. Mm. Which fictional Netflix drama saw 456 players, all in deep financial debt, compete for a chance to win huge sums of money? Oh, yep, go for it, Eric.
The Squid Game?
It's Squid Game, yeah. Well done. Well, have you seen it?
No.
Me neither.
No, me neither.
No, I've heard it's a big deal, though, and I really should give it a watch.
Everyone's like,
watch it.
But haven't seen it.
Yeah. No, I haven't seen it either.
Fair enough. Well done.
Played,
congratulations. 5-4.
It was a good game. Good questions, Alex.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Especially like our agreement.
Some of them seemed a bit random. Would you both like the bonus question? Because this one was quite interesting.
Sure.
I'm not sure how they work this out. So this is a closest wins. So whoever gets closest wins, because I mean, if you manage to guess this right, I will be more than impressed.
Okay.
How many times does the average human blink in their lifetime?
Oh, what?
Don't know how they work this out.
It's got to be
someone sat there and counted
for an hour and then just multiplied it by whatever.
I guess that would make sense.
It must be loads, because you must, just in a given day, you must blink thousands of times, right? So I'm going to guess.
So far, my son.
Wait a minute. I'm trying to think of a realistic number now. 1 billion.
Just getting to the right.
1 billion, I think.
1 billion, okay.
1 billion? Yeah, was that
what Robin?
Yeah, I think the human on average blinks 1 billion times in their lifetime.
Then I would say 10 billion.
Oh.
10 billion.
Wow, okay, really going for it.
Well, the actual answer may surprise both of you. It's 657 million is the average. That was again, not sure how they worked that out, but
Also, you say that's the average.
That's it.
So that means there's some people who do blink billions of times and other people who just don't blink at all.
There you go. I mean, take that answer with an extreme pinch of salt, maybe. But, yeah. well done, Eric, on winning the quiz.
Yeah.
And,
thank you.
Thank you again so much for coming onto the podcast and bestowing us with your knowledge and your insight of the police, working with the police for so long.
Thank you so much.
Well,
and
thank you for having me. And I hope that you liked what I said and we talked about it. I hope that your listeners do as well.
Yeah, we look forward to hearing everybody's feedback and comments. And if you want to, please, on YouTube, comment below or send us a message on Twitter. I'm at AllTimeRobin, or you can send it to at JInterestingYT. Your thoughts and comments on the topics we discussed. And I'd just like to recommend yet again Eric's book, which genuinely I loved. I loved it. It was great. And we'll put links in the description of the podcast on all platforms, so you can go over and check it out if you're interested. And I do thoroughly recommend it. So thank you again, Eric. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, both of you.
No problem at all. Thanks again, for coming on to the show. And thanks, everyone, for listening to this week's episode. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.
Bye.